Welcome to Sound Practice, the business podcast for physicians and healthcare leaders, hosted by Mike Tsakopoulos and produced by the American Association for Physician Leadership.
Giving or receiving the talk was uncomfortable for most of us. Discussions of sexual behavior, while necessary, can be difficult. When these discussions happen in the healthcare field, they come with additional complexity. Whether it's a colleague behaving inappropriately or a patient sexually harassing a staff member, the occurrences are all too common. The days of boys will be boys have largely given way to little tolerance and possible litigation. Into this minefield wades my guest. He comes prepared with a roadmap and recommendations for those faced with addressing the sexual misconduct of others. Prepare to talk about the unpleasant realities of sex in healthcare. Next on Sound Practice. My guest today is Matthew Mazurek. Dr. Mazurek is an assistant professor in the Department of Anesthesiology at Yale School of Medicine. He is also an author of national note. Dr. Mazurek's newest book is Sexual Misconduct, Harassment, and Discrimination in Healthcare, which is published by the American Association for Physician Leadership. Matthew Mazurek, welcome to Sound Practice.
Thank you very much. I'm excited to be here and discuss this rather difficult topic, but definitely worthy of conversation.
Absolutely. Maybe difficult, but very important. Before we dive into your new book, could you tell me about your path to becoming a physician leader?
Well, it was a circuitous, if you will. When I was in college, I was actually president of the Astronomy Club in Fresno. So I already had kind of a primed pump, if you will, for leadership and leading. And it's really out of that volunteer spirit. So when I joined Southern Arizona Anesthesia Services down in Tucson about 20 years ago, about 4 years into practice, I decided I want to be on some committees, make a difference in the hospital, help with patient throughput, and also, you know, represent our group in a professional way and not just advocate for our own interests, but for all my fellow physicians' interests as well, including the surgeons and hospitalists. So I think I fell into leadership out of that desire to serve others. And, you know, not to sound cliche, but servant leadership is my style and always has been.
Excellent. Well, the new book, Sexual Misconduct, Harassment, and Discrimination in Healthcare, is a bit of a departure from your previous work. How did you become interested in the topic?
Well, it's interesting. My first book was on physician professionalism, and the reason I wrote that book was out of a desire to educate new physicians and even experienced physician leaders navigating some of the landscapes of navigating physician misconduct. It's very difficult for us to police our peers, if you will. You know, the traditional approach has always been one of these things where we kind of slap each other's hands and say, don't do that, but the behaviors persist. So that's why I wrote that book out of some of the case studies I had when I was chair of professional behavior as a chief of staff and as a chair. It's difficult, it's awkward, and I think having a blueprint and a roadmap is very important. I did write a brief chapter on sexual misconduct and harassment in that original book. When I joined Yale, it was kind of one of those serendipitous things that happened. Someone at one of the insurance companies got a hold of my book. And so, long story short, I was invited to be on a sexual misconduct committee here at Yale. And so I joined the committee. I was on it for approximately 1 year. And just as I knew that there was a gap in professionalism book, I searched for, you know, additional information on handling these issues. And there really isn't anything out there that's as comprehensive as what I wanted to do, addressing specifically sexual misconduct and harassment in healthcare, not just from the staff perspective, but from the patient perspective and what, you know, contributes to the ongoing issues. So really it's a stopgap book is what it is. It helps fill a need.
Well, Let's start with the scope of the problem. Can you speak about the prevalence of sexual harassment and misconduct?
Well, it's a lot higher than a lot of people care to realize. And I think it's because a lot of it continues to go unreported. Mm. But numerous confidential surveys, and I talk about this at length in the book, people do describe that, you know, it's an ongoing problem. 50-60% of female medical students, for example, graduate having experienced directly or indirectly sexual misconduct, or at least witnessing it. And some, of course, are witnessing multiple events, both from patients and faculty and peers. And, you know, even in the professional realm, female faculty especially continue to be discriminated against. They have to endure sexual harassment and misconduct. So there are a lot of cases out there. So the bottom line is it's still prevalent and it's still a problem. And some of the statistics actually startled me. I did not think it would be as high as it remains.
Is it better, worse, or the same when compared to other industries? I'm just wondering if healthcare has a particular problem with this issue.
Well, as professionals in STEM, I think it's similar to other industries. However, medicine does differ than, let's say, engineering or physics, where it's predominantly men. Whereas in medicine, there's a broader mix. So I don't think it's nearly as prevalent in healthcare on the professional to professional level as it is in some of the other STEM fields. However, from patients, you know, who are technically those who we interact to staff and staff to patients, because of that vulnerability and that huge power dynamic, and the fact that we physically touch our patients on a daily basis in most specialties, the opportunity is there for inappropriate touching, inappropriate comments and behavior. So I think it's higher on that spectrum, and I probably think that it's lower from peer-to-peer and professional to professional.
Are there certain specialties that seem to be more prone to harassment and misconduct issues?
Well, I really didn't find a whole lot of evidence in the literature to support an overwhelming difference. But in some specialties, for example, urology, obstetrics, gynecology, where patients are routinely exposing themselves and they're very, very vulnerable, it's a lot more prevalent, I would say, in those particular specialties. And in dermatology, ironically, men or male dermatologists, for some reason, were sexually harassed by some of the female patients, for example. And, there are some comments, in fact, that I put in the book to that effect that, you know, female patients sometimes make inappropriate comments towards male physicians. For example, they'll ask them if they're married and what they're doing and, you know, you want to go out for dinner, and they'll even make comments about their appearance. And of course, most men are able to blow some of these comments off, even though they're wildly inappropriate. And that's the double standard that we also have in healthcare and with this issue. You know, men who are harassed, which it does occur, just don't report it out of embarrassment and everything else.
This is one of the good things about the book that you've put together, is you address the patient misconduct to providers and staff. And I think so oftentimes we think only of providers or staff misconduct when we address this issue in healthcare. So first off, hats off for that. Do you have any sense of how common this is for patients to behave inappropriately?
Well, it's a lot. It's very common. I mean, for example, you know, and I'm not going to get into I can't get into the specifics because of the confidentiality. But, you know, of course, on our committee, we investigate and listen to all types of cases. The ones that, you know, we hear about in the news are usually the more egregious cases. But there are numerous instances, for example, you know, medical students going into a patient's room, for example, and the patient making an inappropriate comment about one of the medical students' appearances, or, you know, will you go out with me? And of course, all of us, if we're in acute care settings and dealing with vulnerable patients who are impaired, anybody on drugs and alcohol, you never know what's going to happen. So it's very, very common. I mean, I myself, over the course of my 25-year career, have either witnessed or heard numerous comments, especially in the emergency room and, you know, occasionally in the operating room when we're giving medications that alter their mental status. They can make inappropriate comments towards the staff in the operating room too. And it's very awkward and it's uncomfortable. But unfortunately, it's kind of part of the journey, and how are you going to navigate that as part of the journey of being a physician? And it happens.
Dr. Mazurek, I follow the Federation of State Medical Boards, and their emails, sadly, typically contain reports of physicians being disciplined for sexual misconduct around the country. And I have to tell you, I'm shocked at how long of a history of sexual misconduct many physicians have before consequences are imposed at the board level. Do you have a feel for this temporal component of addressing sexual misconduct?
Well, if we think about the actual legal process to discipline a physician or actually, you know, investigate some of the concerns and complaints, first of all, you have to verify at least some of the veracity of the allegations and that sort of thing. You know, there are patients who, and I address this in the book, it's not common. It's more rare, but they will make allegations that are false. So there's part of that temporal component with just doing the investigation, which sometimes can take several weeks or even a couple of months, unless, of course, it's very egregious. There's camera evidence, et cetera. Those kinds of cases are what I call slam dunks. Mm-hmm. But some of these more subtle ones where patients, for example, are reporting inappropriate touching or comments in private exam rooms, in clinics, or, you know, in other settings. First of all, who does the patient report it to? They can complain or make a report to the state medical board about the physician. That chain of command, of course, from each state, there is no standardized universal approach, because we have 50 different state medical boards, and there are different laws on the books on how to approach this. So I think that lack of standardization contributes to it. The other thing too is, you know, as physicians are employed, HR gets involved. And if the physician is private practice and has privileges at a hospital, and let's say an incident occurs in the hospital, then it becomes a medical staff affairs issue as well, which that pathway is much, much different than if the physician's employed. The other thing too is some people may fail to follow up. I think some of these issues can be very embarrassing for some of the managers and other people to report. So there's a hesitancy in doing so, and also not wanting to set themselves up for reprisal or any type of legal consequence. So it's a difficult thing to investigate emotionally. It's also difficult because it can have profound professional and personal consequences beyond just the incident itself. So all of these factors really lead to what I call, there is no straight line. I mean, it's basically this: these events occur, and then a spider web ensues, if you will. That's how I like to think of the blueprint. And that does create issues.
Not every example is as egregious as some of the ones that that we might think about or that we read about making the national news. In chapter 7 of your book, Sexual Misconduct, Harassment, and Discrimination in Healthcare, you write about microaggressive behaviors. Can you talk a little bit about microaggressive behaviors and maybe give us some examples?
Well, I think, you know, microaggressive behaviors, and I like to think of sexual misconduct and egregious conduct as kind of on a continuum. Mm-hmm. You know, in society, we have stereotypes. So, you know, stereotypes for both gender, and we have stereotypes for race, we have stereotypes for age, et cetera, et cetera. Those lay the foundation for people having what I call prejudice. Now, what I mean by that is prejudice and bias is when you see an individual, we automatically make some assumptions based on their appearance, based on their age and gender, et cetera. So what happens is with that kind of a foundation, we now have a framework for microaggressions to occur. In other words, use those stereotypes to lay blame or make assumptions about a particular individual. You know, for example, you know, men who don't want to report sexual harassment or misconduct, some people might say, well, he probably enjoyed it. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a microaggression. Same thing if there's a staff in a meeting, let's say there's a female physician who is a chair of a department, and let's say the CEO of the organization is in a meeting and addresses the female physician by her first name, but is deferential and says doctor to all of the male physicians in the committee meeting. In fact, that's one of the cases in my book where there's that sleight of hand where she's not being treated with the same level of respect as her male colleagues, for example. So, I mean, there are numerous examples of microaggressions. That's one of them. And, you know, what happens is, of course, that makes the female physician, you know, feel a little bit less than her peers. And so that's a form of, you know, a micro discrimination, if you will.
Is it easier to overcome or to make an environment where the microaggressions do not occur than maybe some other issues? This seems to me to be maybe one of education.
Yeah, it is one of education. A lot of training programs don't address these as much as they should. A good comprehensive training program for all employees would include this. I'm fortunate here at Yale, we include it in our training program. It's very comprehensive. And it's actually quite impressive. But I've had other modules from other organizations that I've had to take, for example, to be credentialed. And some do a pretty good job at it. Now, the other thing, too, is, though, raising that consciousness and awareness and about our bias about those types of behaviors is also best addressed with using case examples, you know, not just, in other words, not just telling people about it, but showing them how it actually impacts those individuals. Organizations don't have the time, but if people were to get into small groups and do some of these case studies live, they would then feel viscerally the emotional impact of these behaviors. And that's what's really missing in a lot of training programs, because if you don't feel it and understand the impact from that perspective, it's difficult to relate to it.
It's a good point. Very good point. Early on, we were speaking about patients behaving inappropriately towards staff or provider. Let's walk through a situation where maybe a patient has said something or done something that is, I think we could all agree, falls in the category of harassment. What would you counsel the provider or staff member to do, and what should happen with the patient long term?
Well, this is an excellent question. You know, staff have different reactions to these events, and some of them, of course, don't get reported. I think the more egregious comments and statements, and especially if there is any physical touching involved, usually do get reported. But I think the verbal comments alone, for example, it does become a little bit tricky. First of all, is it witnessed or non-witnessed? If it's an unwitnessed event, then it becomes a little bit more difficult for anything to get substantiated. However, what's best is for staff to extricate themselves from the situation. If they report it to a manager or a superior, if it's disturbing enough, relieve them of duty. And then, you know, take notes, investigate, interview the patient. Some patients actually do admit to saying some of these things, others don't. But then from that point forward, the real good strategy is for anyone to walk in that room, seeing that patient can't go alone. So going forward, some charts can sometimes, if the behavior is egregious enough, they will get flagged, you know. So at least the staff is somewhat aware that this is a possibility. There are instances, of course, too, where the patients are behaving so inappropriately to staff on numerous levels, despite trying to intervene, that the patient basically, essentially, quote unquote, gets fired from the practice or the healthcare system, but without having someone to transfer that patient's care to, you can't really abandon the patient either. So it's really, you know, it's a legal, moral, ethical problem. Plus, we also have a responsibility to provide that caring, safe environment for the nurses, physicians, and other workers at the hospital. That's also a moral, ethical duty. We shouldn't leave them in these situations. So I think employee support programs, the flip side is an employee support program also is very, very important. And I think offering that kind of level of support confidentially is also very important.
You spoke about being involved in investigations. And as you know, our audience today is full of healthcare executives and physician leaders. Unfortunately, some of them will have to investigate claims of sexual misconduct. Do you have some pro tips for them as they head into an investigation?
Yeah, and this is, you know, I bring this up when I'm teaching my course on professionalism for the AAPL. Be objective, be professional, be fair, and be unbiased. And I know it's very difficult for individuals to do, but just get the story and strip away who's telling the story and just listen to what's happening. Be exceptionally objective and also be exceptionally curious if something seems unclear. And also, I think, too, looking for consistency is also one of those important matters. Interviewing complainants and interviewing respondents requires somewhat different approaches. You know, respondents, it's often best to not interview those individuals alone, whereas complainants, staff can interview those individuals alone as well, especially if they're feeling vulnerable. The problem, though, is when you have an unwitnessed conversation, then there's always this potential of he said, she said. So I think the best approach, too, is to have at least two individuals to do the interview. The other thing, too, is doing that also takes a lot of the burden off of just one person, sharing that responsibility. More than two people and the respondent or complainant can sometimes feel ganged up on. You know, for example, if someone's had an allegation against them and you've got three people across the table bombarding them with questions, they're going to feel more as if they're at a Spanish Inquisition than they are at some objective fact-finding mission. So when I was engaged in any of the misconduct allegations, especially when I was chief of staff, I just interviewed with one other person. It's a lot less intimidating. Then we take notes and we can corroborate and also verify what was said or not said if there are any issues from a legal perspective. And I think that that's what's really important is to, if there's high stakes, involve risk management right away. I mean, it's not, you don't want to do this alone.
Do you recommend the investigations be conducted by individuals that do not know the people involved with the incident?
It depends upon the circumstances. You know, in smaller places, that may not even be possible. You know, a small rural hospital where I practiced in northern Minnesota, everybody knows everybody. It's absolutely, it's impossible to do something along those lines. But confidentiality has to be discussed, especially in those particular settings. In larger healthcare systems, you know, such as a Yale or let's say Mass General or UCLA, I mean, if you will, they're very, very large institutions. There, professionally trained interviewers and investigators can take the charge. So, and those institutions, there are just simply more resources to do that, and there are more options and there's more training.
It should be everyone's goal to prevent sexual harassment in the workplace instead of being an expert at investigating it. What recommendations can you give to promote prevention?
Well, I think first of all, as physician leaders, laying a groundwork as a role model is very, very important. You know, physician leaders or executives who are engaging in some of these behaviors themselves set a tone in the environment that's tolerant to the behaviors. And I think setting that example as a role model is the first goal. Secondly, having managers who are trained and also having those managers also be role models helps to foster that kind of an environment where these behaviors, they really aren't tolerated. But I think it's very difficult to be consistent and be objective and be fair, because in these work environments, favoritism, gender bias, other instances of politics and whatnot can really influence some of the investigations or some of the behaviors. For example, you know, someone might even say, well, that's just who they are. You know, if they say an off-color remark or if they say something inappropriate, well, this is just, they do this all the time. Well, it doesn't mean it's acceptable. So, you know, you sometimes just have to play cop and go in there and say, listen, you know, this may have been something we tolerated in the past, but moving forward, it's not really a professional behavior, and it's negatively impacting the work environment, and, you know, kind of move on from there. And it's difficult because we're trying to contain these behaviors in a box. And then as soon as the employees or staff or anyone actually exits the building, they can go behave as they want to in their personal lives. So it's maintaining that professionalism, in other words, needs to be kind of a locked door. You come in here, this is the expectation. Obviously, they have no control over what happens outside.
To that end, how much of a problem is social media?
Huge. The bullying, you know, inappropriate pictures, comments, things along those lines. I do put a few examples in the book, but I'm a real stickler for not being friends on social media, Instagrams, and some of those things at work can be really compromising. So it's just not a good idea, you know, and then just don't post anything about work colleagues without permission. And never, ever post anything that could be potentially compromising in any way.
Would you agree with me that this is more of an issue with younger colleagues and staff that have grown up in an environment where so much is shared and so many things are put online that maybe somebody of my age would not think to do?
Yeah, no, I definitely agree. You know, the younger physicians and younger staff, they grew up with social media, for example. It's been a part of their fabric of their life. And I'm Gen X. It hasn't been. So, you know, we had Facebook. That was our introduction. And a lot of us kind of stick to some of those types of platforms, but it's not as common. Most of the problems are with the younger generations. So they share a lot. They send inappropriate texts and, you know, pictures and things along those lines. And, you know, the other thing too is, of course, these occurrences happen outside of the workplace. So, you know, let's say somebody goes on a conference to Europe, you know, what's the jurisdiction, for example, for the behavior, since it didn't happen within the walls or during technical on-duty hours at work. So a lot of organizations now are creating policies that expressly address the fact that social media and any interactions with work colleagues in any way are considered a work environment, if you will.
We talked a little bit about maybe there's been a change of terrain over the years, and I'm interested in your thoughts of where we as a country are when dealing with sexual misconduct. I feel sexual misconduct was traditionally a social issue, which more recently, maybe after the Me Too movement, has become a legal issue with some legal protections. And now it feels like sexual misconduct is also becoming a political issue. Would you agree with that?
No, absolutely. It's a political issue. I mean, contemporary events, of course, and recent cases course, the Me Too movement with Weinstein, and then the famous case, or infamous case, if you will, with Larry Nassar, the physician for the U.S. gymnastics team. I mean, these two cases have really brought to the spotlight the ongoing concerns and issues. I think, though, too, some people may disagree that this is continuing to be a problem, only because they say, well, men are like this and women are like that, and this is the way we are, and this is the way it's always going to be. And I just don't, I think that's a cop-out, if you will. I mean, it's changing these types of behaviors and changing the tolerance for them is absolutely necessary, especially in healthcare. I mean, 60% of the workforce, the physician workforce now, is women are rising through the ranks, if you will. So, but to your original question, I think it's being challenged, and I think that there are a lot of people who are pushing back, saying women are being too sensitive to the issue. And I completely disagree with that. I really do. I think they're empowered, and I think they should be listened to. But the power dynamics within our society leave women vulnerable.
Well, the book is certainly very, very important and timely. As our time together comes to a close, I'm interested in what we can expect from you in the future. What are you working on?
Well, right now I'm currently going to be editing, and I am editing a systems thinking book for physicians on navigating change and project management in healthcare. There's three other editors here with the AAPL. The other book I'm going to be writing probably within the next 2 to 3 years is physicians and mental health and the journey that they go through. I think that's another important topic. The Lorna Breen Foundation, which I'm an ambassador in for preventing physician suicide and physician well-being, is a topic that's been near and dear to my heart for a very, very long time. So working on that, poetry, I'm going to start doing some novels and creative writing, and veering off a little bit and exploring some other avenues besides some of the objective things that I've done. But there's a lot more to come, that's for sure.
Well, that's good. That's good news and a high point to wrap up on. You're certainly doing very important work and are a true physician leader. So thank you, Doctor.
Thank you.
My guest has been Matthew Mazurek. Dr. Mazurek's newest book is Sexual Misconduct, Harassment, and Discrimination in Healthcare. Dr. Mazurek, thank you so much for being on Sound Practice.
All right. Thank you. I appreciate it.
My thanks to Matthew Mazurek. Dr. Mazurek has taken on an important and necessary topic for physician leaders. His book is Sexual Misconduct, Harassment, and Discrimination in Healthcare. I recommend it highly. My thanks also to the American Association for Physician Leadership for making this podcast possible. Please join me next time on Sound Practice. We release a new episode every other Wednesday.
You've been listening to Sound Practice, the business podcast for physicians and healthcare leaders. Check out the show notes for this episode at soundpractice.com. If you have any suggestions for future episodes, we'd love to hear them. Email us at info@soundpractice.com. Subscribe to Sound Practice wherever you listen to podcasts so you can automatically receive our episodes. And please rate us and comment on the podcast in iTunes and Google Play. Sound Practice is presented and produced by the team at American Association for Physician Leadership. We are the world's premier organization for all aspects of physician leadership in every sector of healthcare. Learn more at physicianleaders.org. That man Robin, Rick Capel.